We are going to be on the record in docket number 85668. Justice Pickering is participating from Las Vegas. Justice Lee was disqualified on this matter. So you have the five of us here in Carson. You know the gig at this point. You each have 34 minutes, the first 2 minutes of which are uninterrupted. Do you wish to retain any time for rebuttal?
Did you say 34 minutes,
Your Honor? I'm
17 or
34? No. It's 34 minutes total. Each side has 17. The first 2 minutes of your argument will be uninterrupted. So to the extent you'd like to present to us, you know, the outlines of your argument or however you choose to use that time. But how much time would you like to retain for rebuttal?
5 minutes, if I could.
5 minutes? Perfect. Okay. All right. And Mr. Werfelin, you can start as soon as you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Brennick Werfelin. I'm here on behalf of the Commissioner of Insurance for the State of Nevada. We're here today because of the respondent's unlawful mismanagement of a Nevada risk retention group, causing great harm to the residents of these care facilities and their families, as well as the state of Nevada. There are numerous appeals consolidated in this case. Regarding the satisfaction of judgment entered by the district court, the corporate defendants have acknowledged that this court's May 30th, 2023 order determined that the satisfaction of judgment was void along with the order that entered it. So I will attempt to focus my time on the remaining issues. First, the district court abuses discretion in denying the commissioner leave to amend its complaint to comply with the Kerr standard against the director defendants. Second, the district court correctly denied fees and costs that were requested by the director defendants. And third, the district court improperly denied the commissioner's costs in part against the corporate defendants. The district court abused its discretion when it denied the commissioner leave to amend her complaint against the corporate defendants to comply with the Kerr standard. Denial of motion for leave to amend is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. And an abuse of discretion can occur when a district court bases its decision on a clearly erroneous factual determination. That's what happened here. The district court's denial of leave to amend was based on the clearly erroneous factual determination that there were only 2 months left of discovery at the time that the motion to amend was brought, which was immediately after the Kerr decision was entered. However, the trial court's decision was actually inaccurate. There were actually 5 months of discovery remaining at the time of the motion to amend. There was a scheduling order that had been entered August 25th, 2020, that stated that the close of discovery was actually in October. After that scheduling order was entered, the court heard the motion for reconsideration of the motion to amend and denied it, specifically stating that it was based on the fact that the age of the case, as well as the fact that there were only 2 months left for discovery. However, the next day, the court corrected that scheduling order and put the close of discovery at the correct date, which was December 17th, 2020. And the difference between those two dates was substantial. The discovery had been open before the rector defendants were dismissed for over 18 months for them to do discovery. They had done substantial discovery, and when the court made her decision, the error between the time remaining for discovery and the time that the court believed was remaining for discovery was substantial in this case. That constituted a clearly erroneous factual error, is the commissioner's position. Second, the directors had...
Mr. Werfelin, I just want to clarify the timeline that you just walked through then.
Certainly.
If you're saying it's a clearly erroneous factual determination, but if I understood you correctly, you were saying that after the order was entered denying leave to amend, then there was a corrected scheduling order or a different scheduling order entered. Is that the correct sequence?
Yes. There was the initial motion to amend, and then there was a motion for reconsideration. And on the day of the motion, that the motion for reconsideration was heard, the trial court denied it and said, as part of her reasoning, there's only 2 months left of discovery, I'm not gonna allow that.
Right.
Same day, actually, it was the next day, the court actually corrected that scheduling order and noted that there were actually 5 months of discovery left, but there was the denial of the motion to amend remained, if that answers Your Honor's question.
Yeah, so at the time the court denied the motion to amend and denied the motion for reconsideration, the scheduling order was showing 2 months left.
Yes, actually at the time of the motion, it's because there was the COVID stay, and there was also a stay that during the CUR writ petition. So at the time of the motion to amend, I don't think the scheduling order had yet been entered, and it was subsequently entered prior to the motion for reconsideration. So at the time we had the hearing on the motion for reconsideration, there was the erroneous scheduling order, which the court had relied on in determining that there were only 2 months of discovery left. Subsequently, the court issued the corrected scheduling order, which noted that there were 5 months for discovery.
And sorry if this is a silly question, but was there a subsequent motion calling to the court's attention, hey, you relied on 2 months left in discovery, but in fact, there's now 5 months?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe there was a subsequent motion. What the course that the commissioner took was to file a writ. The court had actually stated that she would enter a stay to allow the commissioner to file the writ on her decision to deny leave to amend, and that's what the commissioner did.
And our decision in the prior case before us, the prior version of this case that was before us, in our decision there, we specifically left to the district court's discretion whether leave to amend would be appropriate or not. So then your argument for why it's an abuse of discretion is based on this subsequently entered corrected scheduling order.
In part, yes, Your Honor, that's correct, because the district court stated effectively three reasons for her denial. One was there's insufficient time for discovery. She believed there were 2 months left. There were actually five. Two was that she determined that the motion was untimely, the motion to amend. But we actually filed it once the stay was lifted on July 1st, after the CUR decision was entered. We filed it July 2nd, the very next day, which was within the time frame that the district court had given us to file motions to amend for all parties. And the third reason that the district, which was also an error because the motion was timely based upon the court's actual order allowing us to amend during that time.
The case had been pending like 10 years by then, right?
It was 2020, so it had been pending for a little over 5 years.
Five years at that point.
Yeah.
I was exaggerating.
But weren't the facts in the Fourth Amendment, the suggested Fourth Amended complaint known well before 2020?
They were known to the defendants, Your Honor. They were not known to the plaintiffs, to the commissioner. And that's a point that I did want to raise. I'm glad that you raised that because in their briefing, the director defendants state that the commissioner had access to all documents relevant to the claims that were brought forth in the Fourth Amendment complaint back in 2012. That was inaccurate. There was an order when the receivership was entered back in 2012 that directed both sets of defendants to turn over all documents to the commissioner. But that didn't happen. And it's undisputed that it wasn't until 2018 that the commissioner received over 1.5 million pages of new documents that were produced that related specifically to the issues that were set forth in the Fourth Amendment complaint. That being said, a related point is the fact that the director defendants admitted in their briefing that the Fourth Amendment complaint isn't based on new facts. And it really wasn't. The facts, circumstances, and time frame in the Fourth Amendment complaint were exactly the same facts and circumstances and time frame in the first complaint. The difference really was simply a repackaging, for lack of a better term, recharacterization of the claims against the directors to include knowing violations of the law and intentional misconduct. And I think that's really a key distinction that the commissioner would make with respect to the director's argument. The directors argue repeatedly that Kerr did not represent a change in the law. The commissioner's never taken the position that NRS 78 changed. That's not been the commissioner's position. The difference has been in the pleading standard that's required as to what needs to be alleged in the complaint to state a claim under NRS 78. Under this court's decision in Schoen, which was in effect at the time, the court had made it clear that gross negligence stated a proper claim. NRS 78 was still the same, and it remained the same, but all that needed to be alleged in the complaint was a claim for gross negligence. And in fact, the district court, in response to the director's first motion to dismiss, specifically directed the commissioner to file an amended complaint and allege gross negligence against the directors, which the commissioner did. We relied on that. The trial court relied on that. And we cited a few cases from the federal courts, Judge Dew, Chief Judge Dew, Judge Jones, Judge Dorsey, who all had relied on that pleading standard. The substantive law, NRS 78, didn't change, but the pleading standard did change and incur, and this court specifically disavowed language in Schoen that said that gross negligence stated a claim against directors and officers. And at the time, we had followed the directive of the court, this court, and this court was following the directive of the Schoen court in alleging, determining that gross negligence stated a claim for relief against directors and officers. One of the things the directors note in their briefing, they argue that the language in Schoen was dicta. And we disagree. As we noted, there are several cases in courts that relied upon that for substantive rulings. But even if it was dicta, this court is free to ignore its own dicta, but lower courts are not. They are required to follow the dicta of this court, which is what the trial court did in this case. It's simply the fact that after we had gone through the litigation, the directors submitted their writ petition, which they didn't do for several years into the litigation, and this court subsequently issued the Kerr decision, which changed that pleading standard. But the facts and circumstances of the case remain the same.
What was the status of the five-year rule at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. The status of the five-year rule was that the commissioner was taking a very proactive, careful approach. There was a dispute between the corporate defendants and the commissioner about when the five-year rule might lapse to be safe. The commissioner took the position that the five-year rule could lapse as early as February or March of 2021. And so the commissioner requested that the trial go forward against the corporate directors once, as quickly as possible, once the commissioner had filed a writ on the district court's denial of leave to amend. So there was a subsequent stay entered to permit the commissioner to come to this court with a writ. That was denied, and then the commissioner moved for trial as quickly as possible. It ended up taking place in September of 2021 within the limits of the five-year rule. The courts that have addressed this issue in terms of harm and prejudice and undue prejudice, the directors allege that there is undue prejudice, have found that where generally prejudice is mitigated, where discovery is still open, there's no trial date pending, and no pretrial conferences occurred. That was exactly this case at the time that the motion to amend was brought. It literally brought the day after the stay was lifted on the writ petition that this court had decided. And I believe that my 5 minutes are remaining for rebuttal. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve those minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Nakamura Ochoa? Did I pronounce that right?
Ochoa is fine. Okay. Angela Ochoa.
Thank you.
My name is Angela Ochoa. I represent the Board of Directors. May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court's denial of the motion for leave to amend because justice did not require amendment. The court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the commissioner unduly delayed the assertions of the new allegations and claim for relief sought in the fourth amended complaint. And granting plaintiff leave to file a fourth amended complaint would unduly prejudice the defendants. The undue delay was supported by the record. The universe of the facts span from 2003 through 2012. The commissioner was appointed receiver and given the authority to marshal all books, records of Lewis and Clark in the fall of 2012. By 2020, there were no new facts for the commissioner to use as a basis for leave to amend. It was 8 years since any possible bad act could have occurred and almost 5 years after filing the complaint. The undue prejudice was also supported by the record. The parties were warned in two prior orders to the motion for leave to amend that no further discovery extensions would be granted. Simultaneous to the motion for leave, the commissioner had filed a motion asking for a preferential trial setting and setting forth an expedited discovery schedule. With most of the depositions having already taken place, the parties would have to retake prior depositions on new facts while completing discovery that was previously anticipated before the writ, and that was on an expedited schedule. The prejudice was not just redoing discovery, but also by 2020, there were unavailable witnesses and unavailable documents. While the commissioner claims that Kerr changed the law, he cannot explain why, if the facts existed to support knowing violations of the law, the commissioner did not seek leave to amend earlier, place the parties on notice in any of the prior pleadings, or in any of the discovery before. NRS 78.138 existed substantially unchanged between the period of 2003 and 2020. It had always said intentional misconduct, knowing violation of the law and
fraud. So, Ms. Ochoa, then, if it's the same factual allegations but a different, like, legal theory alleging intent instead of gross negligence, what would be the prejudice to your clients? It's all based on the same facts that had already been the subject of discovery.
They weren't, though. They weren't. We did request discovery. We did written discovery. We took a deposition. And during that discovery, the plaintiff's response was, see our third amended complaint. And the third amended complaint never said that the directors had violated the law by retaining US Ray, knowing that they were an unlicensed reinsurance broker. So that was a completely new fact that the plaintiff was trying to propose in the fourth amended complaint. So if you don't place us on notice in any prior pleadings or in any discovery responses, that's a prejudice. To come 5 years later and expect us to do discovery on an expedited manner. And to your question about the timeline, it was the commissioner that asked for discovery to close in October. So maybe it wasn't 2 months, but it was 3 months that they expected discovery to be closed in. So that's why the judge issued her order. The question that Judge Bell had asked, didn't the commissioner know of the facts by 2012? They absolutely could have, because they had the authority to collect all of the documents that definitely the directors did not have. The plaintiff responded that, well, the directors knew of all of these, their bad conduct. Well, we didn't, right? The directors were subject to the Division of Insurance triennial exams, quarterly reports, and at no point did the Division of Insurance ever cease to fine, penalize any of the directors for their conduct. So we didn't know.
But wouldn't it have been reasonable under shown for the commissioner to plead gross negligence? In fact, that's what they were instructed to do by the judge, rather than intentional torts that were maybe more difficult to prove.
Do I think that it's okay to just plead a lesser standard relying on shown? No, I don't think that's what the rules of civil procedure are there for. I know Mr. Worthland said, provided some dicta, some case law that says district courts can rely on dicta, but it does say if that dicta is well-reasoned. And in this case, it wasn't well-reasoned. Schoen was a case about demand futility. Demand futility only arises out of NRCP 23.1. It doesn't have to look at NRS 78.138.
Ms. Ochoa,
go ahead.
You agree that the Kerr standard is higher than the Schoen standard, right?
Yes.
So why would, at the time, because you don't know what's going to happen, at the time there was the third amended complaint, they certainly wouldn't be expected to give themselves a higher burden at that point, right?
I don't think that's the point of filing a complaint and placing the parties on notice. Notice of actionable facts and causes of action. I think NRCP 15, the rules of civil procedure allow for parties to plead in the alternative. There was nothing preventing the plaintiff from pleading intentional misconduct.
But why would they plead intentional misconduct? They didn't have to plead intentional misconduct, right?
Because of action at once. So we don't have piecemeal litigation. So we don't have to come back.
The rules of civil procedure just require a short and plain statement of the facts or the claim, right? I mean,
sure,
you don't have to state a whole lot of detailed facts.
Absolutely, absolutely. No doubt. But discovery also allows for the parties to give their full, all of their facts to support causes of actions. And that didn't happen in our case.
But there was also 2, 3, or 5 months of discovery left. I mean, discovery was still open. So why wouldn't it just proceed and you go through discovery and pick up those extra facts? Why in the middle of discovery, why isn't that good enough?
Sure, because there was undue prejudice in proceeding on a 3-month discovery timeline. And again, we're looking at new facts that were not in any prior pleading and not in any prior discovery. It wasn't just changing the pleading to say intentional misconduct. The complaint went from 42 pages to over 100 pages. Mm-hmm. So it absolutely included new facts.
Discovery would be your clients perhaps being redeposed, right?
Right. My clients and other witnesses as well.
Okay. Did the court get a whole analysis of what we can and can't accomplish in the next 3 months or 5 months or 2 months?
Right, and I think
you're too prejudiced by that?
Right, and I think one of the important things that to remember was in this case, we were looking at now alleged violations of the law. So that required us to look at what did the attorney for Lewis and Clark advise the directors? What did the Division of Insurance say to that attorney? And we had taken Connie Akridge's deposition. She was the attorney for Lewis and Clark before we knew of these knowing violations. And she had testified that, you know, she couldn't remember much. And the records were not there anymore. So that's kind of a problem when you wait that long to all of a sudden say that the issue now is that you violated the law.
Was there any discussion about who might bear the cost of any redeposing of witnesses or things of that nature?
No, there was not any, but I think if you look at what has happened since, the commissioner has taken the position that they do not need to pay anything, right? So if this was a...
Are you talking about the fee and cost issue?
Right, the fee cost issue, where they said that they're immune from... sanctions are further from the rules of civil procedure. You know, had we pursued that path, we'd still be in this place where the commissioner says we don't have to pay that. And so,
right.
What is the lesser? What's the next sanction? And this was not a sanction motion. The court looked at the totality of the circumstances.
Would you go ahead and briefly address your client's appeal as to the fees and costs issue and the immunity statute?
Sure. So while the court correctly denied leave to amend, the district court erroneously denied the director's motion for attorney's fees and costs in finding that NRS 696B.565 prevented such an award. Even if NRS 696B.565 protects the commissioner from being subject to attorney's fees, it waived this protection by filing suit against the directors. And I know this court recently looked at an immunity issue with respect to taking a writ and issued an opinion in June of 2025 regarding DFS. So immunity is something that can be waived. Immunity is the concept that as a defendant, if you have that right, you can be prevented from coming to court. And that's not what happened in this particular case. The commissioner specifically came to the court, asked for relief, asked to be subject to the rules of civil procedure, and waived any rights to assert that there was immunity arising out of 696B. Also, if you look at the statute actually contemplates attorney's fees and judgments being entered against the commissioner, because subsection 3 says that, and subsection 4 states that the commissioner can be indemnified from the insurer's assets, and that would be Lewis and Clark, the receivership. So my last argument about why immunity is not appropriate to prevent an award of attorney's fees and costs is because public policy doesn't support this. I mean, the commissioner should be subject to the checks and balances of the rules of civil procedure like any litigant that comes to the courts. The court system is there to benefit and keep people to have just speedy, inexpensive resolutions and cases. And unfortunately, that has not happened in this particular case. If the commissioner was not subject to sanctions, the commissioner would, commissioner's powers would go unchecked. Is there any other questions?
You still have 4 minutes.
That was the 5 minute bell, not the end of your
time. Oh, okay. I do want to make a distinction between this idea that leave should be amended whenever there's a change of the law. The commissioner has presented different cases to support that, to assert that that's the position, and that's just simply not true. If you look at all of the cases had to deal with a change in the law where a claim actually existed but was taken away. In this particular case, there was never a cause of action to support gross negligence. So I believe that all of the cases that the commissioner has cited is not analogous. One of the cases that the commissioner cited is actually quite interesting. It's called Boileau versus Bethlehem. And it was a case where the plaintiff had filed a state action and a Section 1983 federal action. The federal action was stayed while the state court action proceeded. Upon the conclusion of the state court case, the plaintiff sought leave to amend the 1983 claim because of a change of the law. The court went through all of the Fomen factors and found no prejudice because there was absolutely no discovery that happened in that federal case. But the court noted that when a claim involves a deprivation of fundamental constitutional rights, discretionary procedural measures should be cautiously employed. And that is kind of the running theme throughout all of the cases that the commissioner has brought forward for its position that a change of the law should require leave to amend. In the cases that he brought forward, there was allegations of Nevada constitutional violations, the Alien Tort Act, in which one of the plaintiffs said that they were a victim of child slavery. That's just not what's happening in this case. Anything else? Okay.
Mr. Ogilvie intending to argue today?
That's what we weren't quite sure.
You get combined time as respondents, so now would be the time if you're planning to say something. Just saying. I didn't mean to take over, Chief.
Oh,
I just,
no, you're quite all right. I thought Mr. Ogilvie was just sitting quietly and observing.
Oh, so for the aforementioned reasons, I request that you affirm the district court's denial of relief to amend.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, I'm George Ogilvie. I represent the corporate defendants, U.S. Re Corporation, Unitaire Underwriting Management, and Unitaire Claims Services. I kind of feel like I was invited to the party and I got to the guest to the door and I'm not on the guest list. So, we received the court's order setting oral argument, and it because there were one there was one party on this side, two parties on this side. I spoke with Ms. Ochoa and talked about splitting the time, called the clerk's office. They said that's what we should do. So that's what we had intended to do. The issues in the two matters that the corporate defendants are appellees both hinge on a very simple, not simple, but a single issue of law, and that is whether the Commissioner of Insurance accepting a tender of settlement proceeds 5 days after those proceeds were due nullifies the settlement agreement. The trial court, or the district court, found after 7 months of litigating this issue that, in fact, the district court, or that the commissioner waived any claim of breach, specifically stating that the corporate defendants fully satisfied the settlement agreement and that the belated tender of the settlement funds does not void the settlement agreement because plaintiff indisputably accepted and deposited the settlement funds. We submit that this court should likewise rule as a matter of law that the commissioner's acceptance of a late tender of settlement proceeds constitutes a waiver of the claimed breach and that the settlement agreement remains valid and enforceable. Finding that the settlement agreement is valid and enforceable renders the commissioner's cost appeal, which is also pending before this court, moot, as the commissioner's recovery is limited to the $5.2 million that was identified as the settlement proceeds in the settlement agreement and which was tendered to the commissioner in August of 2022, 3 years ago.
Mr. Ogilvie, just briefly, given the procedural posture of the case and other orders that have been issued by this court, don't we have to send that piece back down?
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that question, and I've mulled that over, but I'll tell you, I submit, Justice Stiglitz, that we'll just be back in front of this court at some point, because either way the trial court rules on the enforceability of the settlement agreement, one side or the other will probably appeal. All of the facts have been developed. There's no doubt that there was a settlement agreement entered into by the Commissioner of Insurance and the corporate defendants. There's no dispute as to the terms, $5.2 million. There's no dispute that there was a provision in the settlement agreement that said that these settlement proceeds had to be received within 30 days of receipt of a W-9 and other documentation. And there is no dispute that in fact, the a portion of those settlement proceeds were received by the Commissioner of Insurance after that 30 days. All of those facts are not in dispute, and they won't be in dispute if the court remands this. They won't be in dispute if it comes back up on appeal. So I submit to the court that it is ripe for this court to rule as a matter of law, just as the district court did, that the waiver, that the acceptance of those settlement proceeds by the commissioner, albeit tendered 5 days late, constituted a waiver of any claim of breach, and therefore the settlement agreement. Yes,
why wouldn't we just do an indicative remand and get an indicative ruling from the district court? Wouldn't that be cleaner under 12A? That
would be my alternative request for relief, Your Honor, that the court remand with instructions to the district court to find as a matter of law that the late tender
Sorry, you're cutting out. I'm sorry.
She said
you were cutting out at the end, but we would hold jurisdiction and ask the district court to do an indicative ruling, and then that would allow us to finalize the result, and the case would be over. Is there a problem with that?
I don't believe so. As I said, that was my alternative request. In the event that the court does not hold as a matter of law that the settlement agreement is. Case should be dismissed, that this court remand with instructions for the district court to find the exactly that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to add three minutes.
Thank you for inviting me to the party.
Time.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, I wanted to address the statements by on the director's issue, and then I'll go to the corporate defendants' issues. With respect to the proposed amended complaint not being based on new facts, we cited in our briefing, it's citation AA03970, lines 8 to 11, where the director defendants admit, and I'm quoting, that the Fourth Amendment complaint was, quote, not based on new facts. And that really was the case. There was a restatement of the claims. We agree with that because of the new pleading standard in Kerr. But again, 78 did not change. We understand that. But I think that knowledge that 78.
What, if I might ask, was the extra 60 pages? I mean, it wasn't just a pleading standard.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The complaint grew over time, as the commissioner found out new facts. What the statements were in the additional pages that Your Honor is referencing on the proposed Fourth Amendment complaint laid out the things that the commissioner had found with respect to the time frame that had been alleged in the original complaint. So there was more detail on that.
New facts? It was just a longer explanation of the facts.
That's correct, Your Honor. There were, and I don't want to deny the fact that we did certainly through deposition testimony, we found new issues and clarified those issues. The claims, the statements, and the time frame remain the same. We did also include in the original proposed amended complaint an additional defendant, Mr. Talpachone, and there were several, I don't remember the number of pages, but a lot of allegations directed toward him. We did not seek in our appeal to include him. The district court denied our ability to include him, and we did not appeal that. But that's what that was about. The pleading standard itself, Your Honor, the directors talk about how the NRS 78 always did include a requirement of showing knowing violation of the law and intentional misconduct. That's true, but it's the commissioner's position that really cuts both ways because the directors knew from the beginning that these claims would require that. The question wasn't whether the claims required it. The question was whether the pleading standard required that they be alleged in the complaint. And under Schoen, they did not. You didn't have to put those in the complaint. NRS 78 still said what it said, but you didn't have to put that in the complaint in detail. And then this court said in Schoen that it disavowed Schoen, and the new pleading standard was that the complaint did need to allege those. So that was the difference. But the claims themselves were the same, and the directors admitted that. We also cited the Pisana case, which makes clear that where there is still discovery time remaining, where there has been no trial date set, and there's been no pretrial conference, there is really not any undue prejudice. And in this case, the directors talk about undue prejudice in terms of deposing witnesses, but typically they wouldn't, and I don't believe they did depose any of their own witnesses. It would be the commissioner that would potentially need to go back through and redepose their witnesses in terms of what needed to be addressed, if anything. But at this point, the commissioner was willing to go forward, whether it was 2 months of discovery or 5 months of discovery. The commissioner was willing to go forward at that time on the amended complaint if the trial court had permitted the commissioner to amend to meet that new pleading standard under Kerr. With respect to the corporate defendants, there are a couple of issues there. The first relates to the satisfaction of judgment, as we noted. I don't think it's in dispute. The May 30 order from this court, 2023, found that the satisfaction of judgment was void. However, the remaining issues do create some things that really should be addressed. In their briefing, the corporate defendants cite to this court's decision in Grisham for the prop and EDCR 7.50 for the proposition that the trial court could enforce the settlement agreement. And the trial court first found she did not have any jurisdiction to enforce the settlement agreement because of an appeal. And then she later reversed that, and this court found that reversal was inappropriate. However, there's also the issue of whether the trial court had jurisdiction to even hear anything related to the settlement agreement. And that's where we say the authority that we cite, the Kekkonen case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, is directly on point. In that case, there was a final judgment, and it was a stipulation. And then later, it was a stipulation for final judgment based upon a settlement agreement. After the final judgment, the parties came back to the Supreme Court or to the lower court and said, hey, "Can you will you enforce the settlement agreement?" And the Supreme Court said, "You can't do that. It wasn't the court wasn't involved in the settlement agreement." And the corporate defendants cite to the Grisham case, and they say that between that and EDCR 7.50, the district court did have authority, maybe not jurisdiction because of the appeal, but authority to hear the issue of enforcement of the settlement agreement. And that would be we would dispute that, and for this reason, the Grisham case had a critically important distinction. In Grisham, the parties didn't get a final judgment. After the first day of trial, they went to the district court and said, "Judge, we've reached a settlement. We'd like to put it on the record." And they did that. There was no termination.
Mr. Worth, went to Justice Pickering's point earlier.
Yes,
could we not kind of pause on that particular appeal on that particular issue and ask the district court to give us an indicative ruling?
Well, Your Honor, we believe we would submit that wouldn't be appropriate for the reason that the district court was not involved in that appeal and those, or I'm sorry, in the issues related to the settlement agreement. And those issues related to the settlement agreement are currently pending before another court. So those issues have been raised at a different court.
Explain what you mean by that.
Yes, Your Honor. There's pending litigation. It's happened since the briefing.
So there's a new separate case?
Correct, Your Honor. Correct. Because all of the issues that the corporate defendants raise, breach of contract, waiver, those are all questions of fact for a jury that a jury would have to determine. And the corporate defendants, it's the commissioner's position, they're trying to do an end run around that due process because it's really a separate, completely separate issue. It's not like Grisham where at the conclusion of the litigation, the party said, "Hey, okay, before we get to a final judgment, let's resolve this." And the court says, "Okay, I have authority to enforce that." This is very different. We went through the entire, I won't go into settlement discussions, but there were settlement discussions, didn't work out. We had to go through all the way through the jury trial, jury verdict, final judgment. Only then, when we were pursuing collection, was there a settlement agreement that related strictly to collection on the judgment, not the underlying case. So we would submit that it wouldn't be appropriate to remand it because those issues had already been resolved, and these are brand new issues that are pending before a different court.
But wouldn't that issue have to be resolved to resolve the attorney's fees issue? That seems a little challenging in this particular context because if there's a valid settlement, then there's would be no award of attorney's fees.
Well, I would submit, looks like my time is up.
Yeah, please answer. Go ahead.
Okay, I will answer that. Yes, Ron, that's a great point. The issue with respect to the attorney's fees, well, not the attorney's fees, but the cost that was appealed. Yes, I know. And that issue, if it were, we submitted that to the district court, the corporate counsel showed up and said, "Hey, this shouldn't go forward because there's a settlement agreement," but they hadn't filed anything. And the district court said, "No, we need to go forward," and that's what we had said on the record as well. So our result would be that, no, if it turned out that those costs should not have been entered, that would be for the corporate defendants to pursue in the related action concerning the collection of the judgment, so the separate action, Your Honor, if that answers your question.
I have a quick question.
Okay.
Do you agree with what Mr. Ogilvie was saying about what is undisputed, that there was a settlement agreement, the terms of the settlement agreement, and that it was paid, albeit part of it was paid 5 days late? Those are undisputed.
There are some of those facts that are undisputed. It is undisputed that there was a settlement agreement. It's undisputed that the funds were paid late. It's also undisputed that that settlement agreement contained a provision that expressly stated that if the funds were not received in that 30 days, it would be null and void. However, what we raised with the district court, after the district court first found she didn't have jurisdiction and then later decided to entertain the motion, was that there are about a half a dozen issues with respect to issues of fact that had not been developed, were not developed by the district court. Waiver, for example, he mentioned specifically waiver. That requires an intent element between the parties and a fact finder to determine. So
that wasn't part of the question.
I understand.
It was just that there was a settlement reached, that nobody's challenging the terms that were in that settlement. Not how do they get interpreted and applied, but just what the terms were. And that it was paid, although it was paid in part late.
Yes, those facts we do agree with, yes, Your Honor, to answer your question. I hope I answered that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you.